Dinah Lance is a fighter, and her one-woman war is against the czars of crime, the frightened men who dread the blonde bombshell, otherwise known as Black Canary.
Welcome to Flowers and Fishnets, a Black Canary podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Daly, and I'm happy to be recording this special episode with a guest, making his return to the show for the first time since episode 7 way back in April. It's Chris Franklin from the Supermates podcast. Welcome back to the show, Chris.
Oh, thanks, Ryan. It's great to be back.
As soon as I knew I was doing this episode, I knew that you were one of the guests that I wanted. And luckily, you volunteered yourself before I could even ask, so it was good. It was nice the way that turned out.
I was like, hey, wait a minute, Starman. We do Starman episodes.
Folks, as you can tell from the title of this episode, Chris and I will be honoring the memory of the legendary comic book artist Murphy Anderson. And we'll be doing that by reviewing two issues of The Brave and the Bold. Issues 61 and 62 teamed Black Canary with the Golden Age Starman Ted Knight. Two characters who are very near and dear to our hearts. Is that right, Chris?
Yes, definitely.
You cover Starman fairly regularly on the Supermates podcast. What is your connection with the character?
Well, actually, I was always a fan of the JSA. I met the JSA. I think I bought it was whatever the last issue of All-Star Comics was in the 70s. It was 74 or 76, I can't remember. But I actually had that bought for me. And then I had an issue of Adventure Comics, actually where they're avenging Batman's death, which was quite shocking to a 3 or 4 year old, you know. But from there, anything that had the JSA in it, I was interested in. And Starman, I think I probably met him first in... I don't really think he wasn't in the All-Star run of the 70s much because the Star-Spangled Kid had his cosmic rod and his cosmic converter belt at the time, but he did show up. So I probably met him there, but where I first really noticed him, where he jumped out at me, was in my favorite comic of all time, Brave and the Bold number 182, which is the Alan Brennert penned, Jim Aparo drawn team-up of Batman and the Earth 2 Robin, but Starman is in that story as well. Mm-hmm. And his cosmic rod is kind of the big plot point of that story. So that's kind of where he, you know, kind of entered into, you know, there's always a little special connection with me and Starman. You flash forward into the 90s and Zero Hour comes out. I'm excited. But there's not too many books that are coming out of Zero Hour that honestly look very good. Except this new Starman title, and I say, oh, it's about the son of Ted Knight, I'm in. So that's why, you know, me and Cindy both, we were dating at the time, so we both read Starman as it came out, and that's one of our favorite series, so that's why we cover the James Robinson, Tony Harris Starman. As for Black Canary, I think I may have mentioned this before here, but Black Canary, I met in the World's Finest comics, the dollar comic version of World's Finest. The specific issue that always jumps out into me is where she's getting out of the shower and fighting a werewolf, and she's naked. And they actually show her in silhouette naked. So, and not completely in silhouette. So even though I was like 3 or 4, you know, it just...
Left a lasting impression.
it made a lasting impression, yes.
I first met Starman through the Starman series of that 90s, and even though it's not one of my favorite series, and I want to like it so much, but I have problems with James Robinson's writing style. It's something about his narrative voice. I love the ideas and the concepts that came out of that book, but just the captions, the dialogue, just the voice that he had, it turned me off, but... Every once in a while, like when I would pick up a random issue and I would see when he would have these flashbacks to the Golden Age adventures of Ted Knight, I loved those stories the most. It's Just this costume, this garish big red costume with the fin on the head. It had, it felt like a retro sci-fi vibe because of the fin on his head and the cosmic rod. It was like a lightsaber without the blade. It was just this handle that could do pretty much whatever he wanted. So there was this space age type of vibe to him, but he also had the cape. So it was just this sort of transcendent character that I loved the look of him. He's always been one of my favorite heroes of that era. And when I did find out that he and Black Canary had this partnership over these couple of issues, which then got further explored in later stories, that it was more than just these two adventures that they had together, I really liked the sort of subplot that was retroactively woven between their lives. And we will get into the actual stories in a little bit, but before we do that, as I mentioned off the top, we're celebrating these two stories because they were both drawn by Murphy Anderson. And if you didn't know, Murphy Anderson died on October 22nd of this past year. He was born July 9th, 1926, so he was about 89 years old when he died. Chris, how did you know Murphy Anderson, or how did you know of his work? What were you most familiar with him?
Well, you know, I think probably where I first noticed Murphy Anderson was probably on the licensing art that was on a lot of the products in the 70s, which a lot of it was carryover from the 60s, like particularly the Batman stuff, the Batman artwork in the pre-Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, days. A lot of the artwork was, you know, Carmine Infantino inked by Murphy Anderson. And then Anderson himself did quite a bit of artwork that some of it was used in like the corner boxes on DC Comics in the 70s, but it got used on, you know, products too. And as a kid that ate up everything superheroes, I had a ton of that stuff. And so when I started getting the DC Digests, even back then, I was like saying, oh, that's the guy that drew this. And I didn't know their name, but I could recognize their art style like at a very early age. And so Anderson jumped out at me. I could tell this was the guy. It was, you know, the guy that was inking this Flash story or drawing this Hawkman story in this digest. This was the same guy that had done something on this, you know, placemat I had, or, you know, or something like that, or this Pepsi glass or what have you. And so that's kind of where, you know, I kind of got to appreciate him. He wasn't doing a lot of new comic work in the 80s. I think he was running PS Magazine. Which he, I guess, kind of inherited from Will Eisner, of all people. So, you know, good company. But there was something just so, you know, of the reprinted stories that, like, if they went back into the late Golden Age, early Silver Age, his illustrative style was just, it was just a night and day difference. I mean, a lot of people talk about Neil Adams bringing the illustrative touch to comics, and he did, definitely. But I think, you know, and I know Anderson was a disciple of Lou Fine from Quality, as you've, you know, said on your Secret Origin show. But, you know, he was definitely, you know, his work was definitely more of an illustrative type than your standard cartoonist type stuff that was in. I mean, not that Sheldon Moldoff wasn't a great artist in his own right. If you look at the Batman work where he's emulating Bob Kane, that very flat style was being published simultaneously against, you know, Anderson's very illustrative, very lush, you know, deft brushwork style. And it just leaps right out at you. It's so dynamic compared to a lot of the other work that was being done, especially at DC at the time. And it's so polished versus the very rough stuff that was being done at Marvel at the time. You know, as great as Kirby and Ditko was, there was a frantic energy to it, whereas Anderson had this very polished sheen to everything. And he would even corral artists like Carmine Infantino in, you know, and just basically polish it up. That's kind of the way I kind of look at it as his art style. And one other aspect of his that, you know, he did a lot of licensing work, but he did almost all the artwork on the Ideal Captain Action packaging of the 60s, all the character vignettes on the costume. Yeah, I don't know if you know a lot about Captain Action, but it was basically you bought the Captain Action figure, and then you bought a Batman uniform set, in a Superman uniform set, and he did all the DC characters, Superman, Batman, Aquaman, Robin, Superboy, Aqualad. He did the Super Queens, which were related, so he did the artwork for Wonder Woman, Supergirl, Batgirl, Mira. And there's a set of playsets in the early 70s that Ideal made. They're vinyl playsets that fold up into a little flat, almost like a little carry portfolio thing, and you open them up and they make a play environment. And Anderson did the artwork on the outside and all the figural work on the inside, little cardboard figures of Superman, Batman, Robin. I've actually got those. So it's kind of cool to walk into my, collectibles room and there's like little Murphy Anderson characters, standing there looking at you. So, and it's undeniable. If you know Murphy Anderson, you're like, oh yeah, that's, his Batgirl looks like a Murphy Anderson woman, and of course he inked the first Batgirl cover too. Mm-hmm. So needless to say, I was a fan of Murphy Anderson, and always was. And I especially, one place where his stuff really jumped out at me was probably the first time that it really leaped forward to me was the Who's Who entries he did. Because I think partially because of the fact that he had done that packaging art before. If you look at like the stuff he did for the Super Queens, he had like a central image of the character, and then he had all these little vignettes of them in action. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty much what Who's Who was, the Who's Who entries, plugging Robin Shagshow. But I know they don't like the way he draws his little sock feet, but other than that, he really excelled at that kind of, iconic image of the character. And then here's a really great headshot of their secret identity. And here's a couple of great action shots that encapsulate the character. And I think that's he could nail the essence of a character in just a few images.
Yeah, I knew about some of his merchandising work, but I didn't know about the cap and action stuff. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and actually, I'm kind of blowing my own horn here. A few years back, a company called Castaway Toys did a reissue. They did, well, not a reissue. They took the cap and action figure and made him 8 inches tall, like Amigo superhero. And I actually provided the package design and artwork on those. So I was kind of getting to play in the Murphy Anderson wheelhouse, which was like, knocked me over with, awesome. I can't believe I'm doing this. So that was fun to do. And of course I know Murphy Anderson, but he was actually involved. There's a great book that Michael Urie, of the editor of Back Issue Magazine, wrote about Captain Action for Tomorrow's. And he provided like a new cover with Captain Action on it. And there's an interview with Murphy Anderson in it. So it's out there. If you want to see his Captain Action work in a really nice book, check that book out.
I previously reviewed these two issues of Brave and the Bold that we're going to be talking about. I reviewed those on my blog. We've covered three Murphy Anderson penciled stories on the Secret Origins podcast. So a lot of my familiarity with him is the stuff that he's actually drawn, but besides the stuff that we just talked about, I bet most people, if they've heard of him, they've heard of him as an inker. Particularly his work with Kurt Swan on those Superman books for decades. I mean, from the 60s through the 70s up until the crisis, when essentially they were forcibly removed from the character to make way for John Byrne's new version. And it's hard not to picture Superman in your head and not think of that what they call Swanderson look. That Kurt Swan and Murphy Anderson and version, because they did it for so long. They defined the character. It is sort of like Neil Adams's take on the new look Batman, or like what Jim Aparo would do with it later. Like, you see that so often. It's so prolific, the work that they do with a character, that it just becomes the defined version of that character.
Right. Definitely. Yeah. Yeah, I think people, he also provided a lot of the inks on covers of Justice League, over Mike Sikowski and of course Flash over Infantino, and he did some interiors on Flash, but mostly covers. And it was kind of funny. I've heard Carmine Infantino say, Anderson, he appreciated Anderson's inks, but he felt like he kind of changed his artwork more than he normally would like. But I always thought that the two of them together was better than Infantino inked by like Joe Giella or somebody like that. You know, I just thought it was just more of a, he took the dynamic because Infantino was such a great layout artist and designer. He took that kind of raw energy and like I said before, put a nice sheen on it, you know, and kind of prettied it up, you know. And I think that's one reason why in later years, you know, you see Infantino and his artworks kind of, you know, later years, most people are like, Infantino in later years, not exactly the same. You know, it's got more stylized. But, you know, you've got a secret origin story coming up in like annual number two. Is that the one with the Flash?
Yep.
That Anderson inks. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's like, bam, it's like, that's like classic Carmine Infantino all of a sudden. And that's because of Murphy Anderson.
Right. It's because that's so. And we can talk about this a little bit later, but when I look at his work between when he's drawing himself, when Anderson is drawing and like penciling and inking himself, and when he's, say, when he's inking over Carmine Infantino or Kurt Swan, sometimes the art looks very, very similar. And I wonder if his inking style was making their work look more like his own, but sometimes it looks very different. And I don't have the art education to really know what his approach would have been, if it was heavier inks or if it was lighter. Cause I mean, in these issues that we're going to look at, it seems like he was pretty light in his inking approach. Like the line work seems fairly thin at times and just kind of like, mm-hmm. It is a little bit more, not painterly, but it doesn't feel heavy. And you think for a guy who is known primarily as an inker that they might have a little bit more of that forceful touch. And I don't know. It just seems like they're less defined. It never felt like he was over inking Kurt Swan, if that makes sense.
No, I think he was one of the few people, if you've ever seen any Kurt Swan pencils, Kurt Swan was most definitely an illustrator, like I said before. Mm-hmm. I mean, he put in so many lines and so much shading and really built up. I mean, he didn't just use the side of his pencil in shading. I mean, he built up shading through line work. And Anderson was one of the few artists that went in there and tried to bring all that out. And I think that was why he was such a good inker for Swan. I know George Perez said, you know, when he got to ink him on the last, whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow, he inked the first chapter and Anderson inked the covers. But Perez has said, you know, I have to bring all this out. And well, I think Anderson did. I think he brought it all out. You know, I think a lot of people like George Klein in the 60s, but I always kind of thought he kind of simplified what was there. Once I saw Kurt Swan's pencils, I'm like, Kurt, the one reason why so many people have thought, oh, Kurt Swan stuff, it's fine, but it's kind of boring and this and that, is because nobody inked him right. Except like Murphy Anderson. So that's why when they put Anderson on him, it was like some light switch went off. It's like, well, they finally found the guy that knew how to ink Kurt Swan.
Right. Well, that's a good place for us to take a quick little break. We're going to play some promos for some friends of the site. When we come back, we are going to be talking about The Brave and the Bold, issues 61 and 62.
Are you a geek looking for love? Do you long to find discussion on that special comic, TV episode, movie, or toy that's just right for you? Then why not try Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast? Chris and Cindy Franklin can match you with that certain something to satisfy your genre-related longings, no matter the subject. Superheroes.
But Robin's like, that was really nice of you, Batman. He's like, I had the room loaded with kryptonite. I can turn it on at any moment.
And here's the thing. You're talking about, now think about this. It's an apartment building owned by Batman. Do you not think that Batman doesn't have their place booked?
Sci-fi.
I don't know. You talk about being a sex symbol and stuff like that. I mean, I know a lot of girls thought, you know, William Shatner was it, but I had the biggest crush on George Takei. I did. I thought, you know.
Sorry about that. Horror.
And then when we see the Wolfman for the first time, he's in, I don't know, we don't
a
know.
A long sleeve shirt. And a dark pair of pants.
With a belt.
With a belt,
that's right. And his shirt's buttoned up all the way, too.
Yeah.
And his arms.
So after he changes into this ferocious beast who can't talk and doesn't seem to be able to think beyond just attacking things,
He has lots of dexterity.
He went through his closet and...
I like this outfit better.
Action figures.
I actually had all the figures and all the accessories up to a certain point. I really literally did collect them all, you know.
Including She-Ra.
I was going to get to that, but...
Chris and Cindy have found their own happiness through discussions like this.
I could be friends with him. I could be down with this version of the Ultra Humanoid.
You could be friends with the dude who put his brain inside a mutated albino ape.
I married you!
If you're tired of searching for geek love, then sign up with Supermates for free at supermatescomic.blogspot.com or on iTunes.
Guys, we finally developed our time machine. Should we use it to go back and see how Stonehenge was built?
Or become friends with Hitler and convince him to stay in art school?
Or we could go back in time and get the comic books we missed.
Yeah! Yeah!
The Comic Book Time Machine. A journey back in time to explore comic books. Good and bad. Whether from 7 decades ago or 7 days ago. Join our journey at comicbooktimemachine.com.
Both Brave and the Bold issues 61 and 62 were edited by Julius Schwartz, written by Gardner Fox, and illustrated by Murphy Anderson. The Brave and the Bold issue 61 was cover dated August-September 1965, but according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, a brand new copy would have hit the streets on June 24th that year. The cover, which is very, very busy and very text-heavy, sees Starman and Black Canary caught in a torrent of wind caused by Starman's nemesis, the Mist. What do you think of this cover?
I really like it. I know you said it's busy, but it's that, and Rob Kelly's talked about this, it's that kind of busy that's not busy, because the people, it was probably Ira Schnapp, the unsung hero of DC ads and cover copy. It just looks like his fonts, you know, the way he's got it arranged around the figures. I mean, you'd have a hard time not buying this comic book because, as you say, you know, Starman's got a great look. He's essentially got Superman's costume design with Buck Rogers headgear.
Yep.
And in a different color scheme. I mean, that's pretty much what he's got. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, and of course, Black Canary, she's in a bustier and fishnets. You know, what burgeoning boy, man boy isn't going to want to buy this comic, you know? So I think it's a great cover. And of the two, I prefer this one.
And there's so much color on this too, from the sort of magenta purple background, all the different colors of the Starman and Black Canary to the different colors of the text and the boxes and everything. It is busy, but it's eye-catching, and I think you and Rob are right. It's the kind of where you stop and you have to look at that cover, and you have to kind of suck it all in, like little pieces at a time. And it's the longer you look at it, the more inclined you will be to pick it up and purchase it.
So, definitely.
So. All right, let's get into the story. A wealthy financier receives subliminal messages from a bouquet of flowers delivered by the Drake Flower Shop. The flowers tell the rich guy to empty his safe of all its valuable contents, which the man does under a sort of spell. This bizarre robbery is repeated a number of times, and it draws the interest of private investigator Larry Lance. Larry's wife, Dinah Drake Lance, otherwise known as the semi-retired Black Canary, runs the Drake Flower Shop. While her husband is away, Dinah is visited by her old acquaintance, Ted Knight, better known as the Starman. They agree to meet for dinner, with her husband too, before Ted leaves with a flower tucked in his lapel as a reminder of their date. Ted goes to the local observatory to do research on his cosmic rod. But his senses are disrupted by sound waves emanating from the flower Dinah left in his jacket. The sound waves become the subliminal message commanding another wealthy local to surrender his riches. Ted changes into his Starman costume and goes to the intended drop site, where he finds three goons picking up a bag of loot. Starman's cosmic rod is strangely powerless, but Ted isn't. He leaps into action and fights the goons. Before he can take them all down, one of the goons uses sound waves from the flower to disrupt Starman, giving the crooks enough time to get away. They return to their boss, who is none other than Starman's nemesis, the Mist. Larry Lance returns to the Drake Flower Shop and tells Dinah that every one of the robbery victims ordered flowers from her shop. She protests that her flowers had nothing to do with it, but Starman returns and says otherwise. While they're discussing the case, a sudden shift comes over Dinah, and she orders the men out of her sight. They follow as Dinah goes back into the office of her store and reports the names of her wealthy customers to the Mist. Back at his lair, the Mist does what you can only do in comics, the expository villain monologue, entirely in thought balloons. Ted and Larry explain to Dinah how she and her flowers have been unwitting pawns in this nefarious caper. Enraged, Dinah comes out of her semi-retirement, donning the wig and costume of the Black Canary. Starman, Black Canary, and Larry Lance split up and go to three potential robbery locations, but not before Starman gives Dinah a miniature cosmic rod. Ahem. Black Canary foils the robbery at her location, despite the fact that the Mist's hoods are wearing clothes that make them invisible, because, you know, sure. Starman foils his target, who arrives by helicopter. Larry tracks his group of goons back to the Mist's hideout and radios the location to Starman and Black Canary before he gets captured. Starman arrives first, crashing through the window, but the Mist's sound waves weapons counteract the cosmic rod, leaving Ted weakened and vulnerable to the Mist's invisible goons. Then, Black Canary shows up using the mini cosmic rod Ted gave her. With her own rod, she flies over the Mist's hoods and uses it to nullify their invisibility. Then she levitates the Mist's computers and techno machines, dropping them on the goons. At last, the Mist is able to subdue Black Canary, but she gave Starman enough time to recover and take down the Mist. That night, Ted, Dinah, and Larry go to dinner, and Ted asks her to keep the mini cosmic rod he gave her. But Dinah declines. She's no Star Girl. When she gets back into action, it'll be as Black Canary. So, aside from the constant references to Cosmic Rod, which just make me giggle like a juvenile kid, what did you think of this story?
You know, it's a lot of fun. I think overall, you know, I always got to remind myself, I have nothing but the utmost respect for Gardner Fox. Mm-hmm. But even amongst the Silver Age writers, he was perhaps the most verbose.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a sequence where when Starman decides he has to fight the three crooks that are picking up the bag of money because his cosmic rod's not working. You know, he's got erectile dysfunction. Every action Starman takes, there's one where it says like he's on one knee and then heel to toe on the other, and he has a, you know, throws an uppercut. It's like it's clearly drawn by Anderson, because Anderson is a consummate artist. He's a fantastic storyteller, but there's a panel describing every single thing you see. And I mean, I know that's Silver Age comics, but
right.
This story kind of takes it to that extreme. I have to remind myself when I read an old Justice League or, you know, any, I think Fox was more into that than even like contemporaries like John Broome and Zany Bob Haney and mm-hmm. Arnold Drake and writers like that. He was just much more descriptive. And of course, we know, you know, through various comic histories that really, by today's standards, Julius Schwartz would probably be listed as a co-plotter.
Yeah.
Because he plotted almost every single story he ever put out as an editor. He co-plotted it with the writer. I mean, basically, he had meetings with them and said, what ideas do you have? And they'd throw an idea out to him, and he'd say, we got to do something different. We already did that. And his... You know, his nickname apparently was, it says so in a comic he guest starred in, B.O. Schwartz, for Be Original. I don't think anybody would want to be called B.O., but anyway. So, you know, things like the Mist using vibrating flowers and things like that. I mean, it's very Silver Age gimmicky, but it's a lot of fun. But, I mean, this one's pretty out there if you really stop. I mean, it's the vibrations of the flowers that are blocking the reception of the cosmic rod, and that's why it's not working right. And it's, you know, it's, yeah. it's there's some interesting pseudoscience going on.
Exactly. Yeah, the comic book pseudoscience in this is all over the place. And for one thing, when you've got a villain like the Mist, whose whole shtick is that he has this cloak that turns him into this sort of gaseous vapor type of character, and he's got these very sort of ghost-like powers. But okay, for this story, yeah, he's got flowers that have sound vibrations that can short out his... Okay, why do we need this sort of double and triple mumbo-jumbo in terms of, like, the villain technology? But...
It's almost like, you know, they were sitting... And I know they had already teamed Dr. Fate and Hourman over in Showcase. Mm-hmm. That had come out earlier in the years. There had been two issues of those characters teamed up. And I think I read somewhere where there was a third team-up plan, but I'm thinking it was Dr. Midnight and somebody, but I can't remember what it was. But anyway... So it was almost like, you know, Schwartz and Fox like drew names out of a hat full of JSA characters. And it's like, okay, Starman and Black Canary. Well, what? Well, Starman's enemy's the Mist, and Black Canary had a flower shop. It's like, oh, I got it. You know, it's like, that's kind of, I can just kind of see that meeting, you know, in 1965, how this came about. And it's interesting because Starman was long gone out of the JSA and hadn't been published in years when Black Canary first appeared. So, you know, in actual published JSA adventures in the Golden Age, they never met.
Right.
That they, the first time they met, I think, was the second JLA JSA team up. I think was that JLA number 29, I think, was the where Starman was reintroduced. Mm-hmm. And Black Canary was, of course, in the first one as well. So that's the first time they'd been in a story together. So, you know, we're given this, so it's kind of a retcon that they even are chummy and friends and teammates, because publishing-wise, they really weren't, which is kind of interesting.
Right, and spoilers for any potential listeners, James Robinson and Mark Waid in years hence would eventually play with the idea that these two had a love affair for a time while they were working together. That was in, was that in Starman Annual number 2?
Yes, it was in Starman Annual number 2.
Yeah, I think we talked about it last time we had conversation.
Yes, and you know, we brought up the fact that in the story we did before that revealed the wonky pre-crisis true origin of Black Canary, that they, you know, Starman and her stick together in that story. Yeah. He stayed with her, and you know, you can in pre-revelation of their affair. You can read that. It's definitely because of these two stories that they have this connection, you know, which I think is great. And but yeah, the thing with James Robinson and Mark Waid, and I had almost forgot that it comes up in JLA Year One. You're right,
because it's a big fight between Dinah Laurel Lance and her mother. It's it's similar to the Silk Spectre thing from The Watchmen, but it's this whole idea of her realizing that her mother, who always wanted her to have to, you know, sort of be better than her, was actually pretty flawed, and that whole situation.
Right. But it's interesting too, because in that story, I just kind of flipped through that today, that segment of that annual. That was during the pulp, the year they did the pulp annuals, and so it was like the young romance version. But they basically you know, they're having a conversation in bed after, you know, doing the deed, and Ted's like, well, we got to go back to our spouses. And she asks Ted if he loves his wife. And he said, yes, I do. And it was kind of like, it was almost like the way Robinson presented it. It was like the aphrodisiac of superheroing was just too much for them to resist, you know? Right. And then there's a nasty little angle where the Mist's, one of his, a private detective that's trailing them for the Mist finds out they're having an affair and tries to blackmail them. Hmm. So that kind of ties back around into this one too, if you think about it. So it's kind of interesting, but you know, it's one of those cases where I'm still not 100% sure how I feel about that. There's something I never have decided if it adds to it or it detracts from it. It depends on the day that you're asking me. Right. So,
and I like them as partners. I like the idea of Black Canary and Starman 1,000 times more than I like the idea of Black Canary and Green Arrow. And I have this sort of love and hate relationship with Green Arrow himself, because my favorite depiction, my favorite run with Green Arrow, my favorite extended reading experience with him was the Mike Grell era, which is also one of my least favorite depictions of Black Canary. So,
right.
But part of it is just seeing her, and I've talked about this before, Black Canary and Green Arrow, they're two basically street-level fighters. They don't complement each other. They're a little bit too reflective. They both have very monochromatic outfits. She's all blue with blonde hair. He's all green with blonde hair. But you put her with Starman, and their differences pop. Because then they've got the color schemes of Batman and Robin. And you see this, the way they contrast off each other. It's just so much more interesting. And I like the playfulness. I like the fact that they were both happily married. And if they slipped up and had a short affair and it lasted one night, one week, whatever, I'm probably okay with that. I never wanted to see them leave their spouses for each other and be the couple, but I do like them as partners, and I would like to see more stories exploring that. I would rather her long storied history in the DC universe be associated with Starman than with Green Arrow. Now, given that Green Arrow is 1,000 times more popular, that might have meant that she kind of vanished into obscurity. Now, there's basically two Black Canaries on television right now. So,
yeah.
I don't know. So the choices that Denny O'Neil made for her might have actually been better for the character in the long run. But
Right.
Getting into like some specific elements of the story, just kind of taking it on page 3, the panels at the bottom with Starman at this observatory, or with Ted sitting in front of this machine. This is incredible. It's not a Jack Kirby machine, but it has that sense of scale.
Mm-hmm.
He's just like so small in this seat, looking at this giant telescope and like all of the gadgetry around this. It's beautiful.
Definitely, yeah.
The fight choreography is good. I like it. It is overwritten. Yeah, I agree with you completely. It's one of those things where it's like you can skip all of these panels or skip all of these captions because all Gardner Fox is doing is telling you what you can already see.
You know, I would bet money too that when Starman's talking about it's the panel's like, who is this man called Starman? You know, and it doesn't really give his origin, but it kind of shows a flashback to when he first uses the gravity rod. I would bet money that is Murphy Anderson redrawing a Jack Burnley Starman.
Oh yeah.
Because you know, you guys have just covered the Black Condor over in Secret Origins and how he had redrawn redrawn Lou Fine's artwork.
Yeah.
And I know in the Spectre, when he first, Anderson did the Spectre run in the 60s, when they reintroduced the Spectre in, I think it was Showcase, some of the panels that he did were cover recreations from the Golden Age. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that goes back all the way here to the Silver Age when he's doing that. So
yeah.
I would bet money that because the lighting's different than – it just looks a little bit different than what he would do himself in that one panel, at least. One thing that kind of leaped out at me was, is it just me or does Larry Lance look a little bit like Dean Martin in a couple panels? I don't know if he cast Dean Martin as...
I can see that, yeah. When he's when he's got his finger on her nose and he's doing...
Yeah.
He
kind of looks like little Dino there, yeah. Of course, Dino was... He was big at the time, you know, so...
Dinah also looks like he may have been photo-referencing somebody, and I don't know if it's the hair or what, but she reminds me of somebody, and I can't tell who.
When she's actually Dinah more than Black Canary?
Yeah, I don't know if there's a classical actress that he was referencing.
Yeah, especially like her hairstyle is, it's very combed very close to her head, you know, it's not like it's poofed up as much as when she's Black Canary. Of course, that's a wig, but that stays on really well. I was going to ask you, was Black Canary always based in Park City, or is that a creation of this story?
So I think this is the first and only reference to that. Her Golden Age stories never gave a location of the city, I don't think. I think that's why she was always just sort of basically assimilated into Gotham or something else. this was the first time that they mentioned that, yeah, the Drake Flower Shop located in Park City. And it's not the case in the next issue. They're in Federal City. So it's kind of, it's like, was he,
right.
what, like, was there ever anything else set in the city? I don't think they've ever mentioned it. I kind of wish that she did have her own little beat. Like, that had been more of a, if they had kind of fleshed that out and given her her own little city to patrol, but...
Right. Yeah, it's like in the next one they talk Federal City. I kind of get the impression that's where Ted lives, but you know, I'm not up on all of the Golden Age Starman's adventures, but I'm probably thinking that was an invention too. If it may have been a Golden Age thing, but I didn't think to go look as Who's Who entry and see if it definitely wasn't Opal City. That was James Robinson's invention, obviously. One thing I was just going to point out is, I hate to sound like, you know, a perv here, but do you think that Dinah's cleavage was whited out, perhaps? Because if you look, the way that Anderson draws her top's pretty low cut, and it's just very blank in her. There's like no, you know, line to show, you know, her breast. And I just wonder if that, there's one or two here and there, but it just seems like he's so illustrative, you know, he with his many folds in her coat and her jacket, and of course all the shading on her bodice, that it just seems weird that it's so blank. It just makes me wonder if somebody at the Comic Code Authority didn't take white out to it or something.
Well, now that you mention it, and now that I spend more time staring at her breasts, I think you're right. It does sort of jump out that there's no cleavage line where there obviously ought to be.
I mean, like the few times you see her, he draws the line up the small of her back and things like that, but there's no cleavage line, which is just kind of odd because he draws all the ribs and musculature on the men, on Starman, but it's the cleavage line's missing from Black Canary. So I'm a boob man, but
I see one occasion. It's on page 21. I think that's the only time we see it, when she's sort of obviously like leaping up and contorting, and it's more of sort of like a brushed line kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
So it makes me wonder if they didn't erase it everywhere else.
Mm-hmm. So, a few quick other little notes. When she sort of like snaps under the mist spell, and she says, "Leave my office at once. I have private business to attend to." There's this panel where Starman has to sort of stage whisper to Larry, "Quickly, Larry, obey her."
Yeah.
Just that phrasing and what it implies, like, oh yeah, listen to your wife, do what she says, because we're going to follow her. Obviously, in real life, I would never tell another man that he should listen to what his wife says, because this is 1965, and that's not how we roll, but...
That's right.
There was just the implication of that line is kind of, obey her in order to follow her so that we can find out what's really going on. But it's, that cracked me up.
I know she's a dame, Larry, but this time you'll have to listen to her.
Right. Never mind the fact that she could kick your ass whenever she wanted.
Right. Your poor Larry. I mean, you just get the idea in these stories and the Golden Age stories you've covered. That he really is kind of, I mean, he's kind of the male Lois Lane. I guess Steve Trevor was too, but, and even in referencing that Starman annual again, Dinah even says he's not a very good private detective. She's throwing off on him while she's like, yeah, I guess I kind of love him, but he kind of sucks as a private detective.
Every story was him getting captured, getting caught, and her having to save him, or him accidentally getting her endangered in these little schemes. It was, but
he did save her from Aquarius. So
that's,
you know,
true. He sacrificed himself
with Green Arrow Stick'em Shaft
Stick'em
or whatever.
Shaft. Good time.
Stick'em Shaft and Cosmic Rod.
Oh,
sounds like a '70s movie. Like what was the movie? So-and-so and Lightfoot. What was the name of that movie? Thunderbolt and Lightfoot? Yeah, Clint Eastwood and Jeff Bridges? Yeah, it's Stick'em Shaft and Cosmic Rod.
The Wacky Adventures. Speaking of that, Starman gives her the Cosmic Rod. a little miniature portable version that she can carry with her in her purse. And whew, but she gives it back at the end. She's like, I don't need this. She can take care of herself.
Larry didn't see her for a week. but right. Whoa, sorry. I went there, sorry.
You talked about the Mist being the villain of this story. He was a Starman villain, and that he came back and he was the one who sort of like threatened to expose their affair. Mm-hmm. The Mist sort of became Black Canary's enemy too, in that what was the name of that three-parter in Justice League of America?
Oh,
195 through 197. It was the
classic.
Yeah, it was the Super Secret Society of Supervillains. Because the
right,
Mist,
I can't think of the title of it.
Yeah, but the Mist was the one who attacked Black Canary in the satellite, and he sort of
yes,
because Starman wasn't in that story, but he sort of adopted her as his enemy based on this story. So the Mist was primarily Starman's arch foe, but I kind of consider him one of Black Canary's rogues too. That in as much as she has what pathetic amount of a rogues gallery she has, I consider the Mist one of her enemies too.
Yeah, it'd been interesting if they could have brought her into the Robinson series, but they never really did. I mean, they met in the early days of the JSA revival, but mm-hmm. her and Jack, but they didn't. They may have played lip service to the fact that they knew what went on between their parents, but they didn't. They never did as much with it as you think they would have, and that might be because of the tight editorial reign Denny O'Neill had on the Batman characters, which she had become mm-hmm. property of the Batman office. You know, the DC universe was divided into fiefdoms at the time. So, you had to get approval before you could use certain characters. And, Cindy used to have a theory. She said, what if they ever come out and say that Jack and Dinah are brother and sister? I'm like, oh God, no. Well, they both got black hair. I was like, oh, God, no.
All right. Well, you ready to talk about The Brave and the Bold 62?
Yes.
All right. The Brave and the Bold issue 62 was cover dated October-November 1965 and cover priced at 12 cents. Both of these issues were. And that means Professor Allen could have bought them both for a quarter. Murphy yes. Anderson drew the cover and the interiors, Gardner Fox wrote the story, and Julius Schwartz edited the book. At the annual Sportsman's Show in Federal City, a group of society swells admire the statues of ancient Greco-Roman athletes. One of the statues crumbles to reveal the hidden figure of the dreaded sportsmaster, dressed as a trout fisherman. And he catches a trophy of some kind with his fishing hook and distracts the security guards with baseballs and bowling balls or, whatever. Dinah Drake Lance happens to be dining at the convention center with another man who isn't her husband, Larry, when she hears about Sportsmaster's scheme. She arrives just in time to see Fisherman strip out of his fishing gear and escape on a pair of rocket skis. We switch over to Ted Knight's estate, where, for some reason, he has scale models of famous observatories from different times and places. Suddenly, Ted hears moans or screams from inside the Chinese observatory, which was built like a maze because, sure. Ted changes into his Starman outfit and uses his cosmic rod to fly to the center of the maze/observatory, where he finds his old Justice Society pal, Wildcat, trapped in a cage. The Huntress, this is the original Huntress, the villain dressed in tiger skin, she sicks some hunting falcons on Starman. Lucky for him, at that exact moment, a meteor goes shooting overhead. Starman uses the cosmic rod to shatter the meteor and send fragments of space rock at the falcons so they'll fly away. Huntress bolts for the rendezvous spot with the Sportsmaster. Starman follows her, but Sportsmaster finds him first and hurls a ski like a javelin that strikes Starman in the head and knocks him unconscious. But Black Canary was on the Sportsmaster's trail. She tackles him, then lifts him over her head and spins him around before tossing him into the dirt. But oh yeah, Huntress is there and she attacks Black Canary. Dinah manages to defend herself, but Sportsmaster trips her into a tree, knocking her out. Sportsmaster and Huntress jump into a speedboat, complete with another costume change for Sportsmaster. They race off across the lake, revealing their dastardly union as criminals and lovers. Dinah wakes up and rouses Starman. They return to the observatory, where they find Wildcat's cell is empty. Sportsmaster skis, left behind during the fight, blast off on rockets and return to the supervillain's luxurious chalet, with Starman and Black Canary in hot pursuit, flying through the sky with the power of his rod. They sneak into the basement and find Wildcat and half a dozen dangerous animals locked in individual cages. Suddenly, the cages open and the heroes have to fight the animals. Wildcat boxes a kangaroo and a polar bear, Starman uses his rod on a black panther and a warthog, and Black Canary judo tosses a gorilla over her shoulder back into its cage. Black Canary and Starman follow Huntress and Sportsmaster to a golf course, leaving Wildcat back at the chalet, probably because Starman felt threatened by his masculinity. After a series of weird gymnastic feats all around, the heroes capture the two criminal lovebirds. The trophy that Sportsmaster stole is returned to the sportsman's show, where it is presented by Wildcat's alter ego, Ted Grant, with the other Ted and Dinah watching from the crowd. All right, what'd you think of this one?
I like this one a lot. I probably because, you know, like I said, I read it as a kid. I'm less critical of this one. I do think this one flows better. I think there's more action. I mean, there's plenty of silliness. Most of the silliness in this one actually comes from some of the very strange things that Starman can do with his cosmic rod, which is like create ice cubes and a solid Aurora Borealis shield and a giant tennis racket like Green Lantern would. You know, it's you know, the cosmic rod, they never, Starman didn't appear enough, honestly, for them to really say what it could and couldn't do. I mean, they, you know, it was, they, writers played fast and loose with what it, what its powers were. You know, I mean, from making hard light constructs like a Green Lantern power ring, which nobody even knew back then what a hard light construct was. But, you know, the wonkiness comes from the use of the cosmic rod. And I just want to say before I forget, okay, I like Astral Avenger for Starman. Mm-hmm. I like Blonde Bombshell for Black Canary. Of course, that's what they've called her for years. Girl Gladiatrix for her is a bit much. But the one that kills me for Starman, Rod Ranger. They call him the Rod Ranger.
Maybe they were trying to tap into a different market for their readership.
Maybe they were. But I'm going to have to remember that, so when we do the Starman Chronicles, I will be referring to Jack Knight as the Rod Ranger.
Oh, and Cindy will never stop slapping you.
No, no, but she's not going to anyway, so I might as well give her a reason to slap me. So, yeah.
This story is a lot of fun. The action, the premise, it's all a little bit ridiculous, but you just have to accept that because it's a superhero comic. They're fighting a guy named Sportsmaster, whose gimmick is all of these different... These aren't even, like, extreme sports. Like, when you think of, like, baseball, football, the most popular sports today, no. What are the things that he does, the gimmicks that he affects? Fishing, which, okay, in order to use a fish hook, he also has to have, like, a Bassmaster's vest and like
hip waders.
Yeah, yeah. He's not in water. What is he dressed like this for? What, he's got to put on a polo sweater to go out golfing, to rob a golf course. So
he even mentions that he's wearing the old fashioned golf clothes. And,
yeah.
Did you catch the Goldfinger reference? He throws his little golf, his jaunty cap at Starman. And Starman says something like, oh, a Goldfinger trick. Or it's like, it's like, wait a minute, is Goldfinger a golf reference? I'm like, no, wait a minute, this is 1965. This is Odd Job.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Goldfinger. And the funny thing was, and I just listened today to the Film and Water podcast where Rob was it John Trumbull on there with him today talking about the James Bond, the movie that had Sean Connery's brother in it. But they were talking about how DC, and I had read this before too, DC had the rights to the James Bond comics for like 10 years and didn't know it. Hmm. because they had published a Dr. No comic, and with the rights to that, they had the rights for any Bond comic for 10 years. So when Starman said that, no one at DC thought, we could publish a Goldfinger comic book.
I mean, you talked about Starman doing some crazy things with his powers. Let's talk about the things that Black Canary does in this issue. So, I always support the fact that she is one of, like, at least the top 10 best hand-to-hand combatants in the DC universe. At least that's what, you know, Chuck Dixon and Gail Simone established during Birds of Prey.
The Silver Monkey story, yeah.
Right. She was up there. She trained hardcore, and she could hold her own against, you know, maybe not Batman, but, I mean, Lady Shiva respected Black Canary's fighting status. That tells you something.
Right.
But here we see her. She picks Sportsmaster up. Now, I gotta imagine he's roughly in the area of 200 pounds, mostly of muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And she picks him up, spins him over her head, and throws him into the air.
Yes.
Okay, that's getting into superhuman strength now. And then later she does the same thing to a full, like, 7-foot-tall gorilla.
And speaking of which, I'm surprised that wasn't on the cover, because we know gorillas sold DC comics back in the 60s. Can you imagine the cover with Black Canary flipping a gorilla over his shoulder?
Oh gosh, I would love that. Maybe that's what girl gladiatrix means. It's girl fighter who also has weirdly, bizarrely superhuman strength to lift up much bigger men and animals in order to throw them.
Yeah, that, when I saw that, I mean, well, it's like, you know, and Wildcat, and don't get me wrong, I've always been a big fan of Wildcat. Mm-hmm. I know it was a you know, champion boxer, but he's boxing a polar bear. The kangaroo I can buy, you know, but I mean, the polar bear, I mean, wow.
When I looked at the cover, I was like, oh, Wildcat, awesome. I already love Black Canary. I already love Starman. You know, Wildcat is another, he's in my top 5 favorite Golden Age heroes. I was like, this is perfect. 3 of my favorites, all in one. And when I get to Wildcat in the story, I was like, this is not flattering Wildcat story. Even when he punches the kangaroo and the polar bear, these panels just look sad. Like these.
Yeah, you feel bad for the animals. It's like, aw.
And I kind of feel bad for him that he's like reduced to this. And at the end, he basically calls them out. They're like, we have to go stop the others. And he's like, wait a minute, why are you leaving me here behind? Why are you stranding me here in the chalet? You just rescued me. And Starman's like, we're not stranding you. You're on guard. You have to secure this place.
You have a very important job.
Yes.
We need you to stay here in case someday come back.
Yes. Yeah, like, exactly.
They're so patronizing, you know. The look that Anderson draws, I don't know if it's just the way he draws the mask, but the look he draws on his face, it's like his eyes are really wide. It's like you can just imagine him shaking his head at him while they're telling him that, like, you guys are full of crap, man. You're just leaving me here.
It's basically the look of if this wasn't a comic, if this was like a TV show, and he agreed to make a guest star appearance on this episode, and just realized that, why the hell am I in this episode? I'm doing nothing. Like, I thought I was going to be part of the action in the final climactic fight. And where's my contract? This is horrible. Why am I here?
I lost 20 pounds to fit back into my costume for this? What the hell? It's like,
I don't even get to fight the Huntress, who is my arch enemy? Black Canary is going to take her down? She was my enemy.
Well, speaking of which, the Sportsmaster was Green Lantern's enemy, which, where's he at? You know, it's like, well, you know, it's interesting, too. I brought up Green Lantern because I keep referencing the Dr. Fate Iron Man story, but in the first one of those they fought Solomon Grundy, and they had Green Lantern show up, but he kind of had the same role that Wildcat had here. He was basically in it for a few panels. He actually got turned into a Solomon Grundy-like creature. So you got this very strange image of, you know, Solomon Grundy in a Green Lantern, now in Scott Green Lantern costume, which is just bizarre. But it's like, you know, it's like, let's pepper in another character in these stories and barely use them, you know? So, yeah, it's kind of, yeah, well, this isn't Wildcat's finest hour here by any means.
Other notes on the story?
You know, just, I didn't really jot this down in my notes, but just, if you think about this, the plot of this one, even though this is a year before, this reads a lot like a 60s Batman TV episode.
Yes,
it does. I mean, you could see this as, you know, if they'd already established Sportsmaster and the Huntress as separate characters, then they have a special, extra special guest villain, the Huntress, you know, and they team up and you know, because they the way that the heroes, you know, they chase them about as they go from one thing to the next, and the big set pieces of and the stuffy fuddy duds that the villain, you know, trumps as they steal their money and everything. You know, it's just very, of course, part of that might be because, you know, the 60s Batman TV writers were, you know, borrowing the plots from Gardner Fox and John Broome and Bill Finger and those guys and not giving them any credit. So it's no wonder some Gardner Fox that it come back around, you know, the feeling kind of came back around maybe a little bit, but it does. I could see this being a Batman Batgirl Robin episode where Robin gets screwed into the Wildcat, you know, role, and Batman and Batgirl go off to take them down, you know. So,
and the best part would be when they reveal that Huntress and Sportsmaster got married, Burt Ward would punch his fist and say, "Holy matrimony!"
Exactly. Even criminals need love, Robin. You know, so. We're getting punchy.
Not at all. All right.
You know, just looking these over again, I think we've had so much fun, you know, just with the Silver Age zonkiness. Anderson's work's just so good. It's you almost take it for granted. I mean, because it's just so well done and competent. It's just like every panel there's, you know, like with some comic book artists, you know, there's like a panel or two in the book that really jump out at you and say, man, that's spectacular. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it's fine. But with Anderson, his stuff is so consistent. A Murphy Anderson comic book drawn in the 1950s and a Murphy Anderson comic he drew in the 80s, there's not a lot of difference. I mean, he was consistent from panel to panel, from issue to issue, from decade to decade. So I think that's one reason why, you know, it's easy to you like it, you enjoy it, but it's like you almost take it for granted because it is so well done. And, I, you know, there's some things that, you know, you were talking about the telescope in the other story. Well, you know, he must have got reference for these observatories that Ted Knight has had built in scale. Small scale on his estate, which I can just imagine now Jack Knight like blowing him up with firecrackers when he got to be a unruly teenager. but because he was kind of a jackass, you know. But the things is the Falcons and the car that Black Canary's, you know, driving. Everything is drawn. It's not like so hyper realistic that it leaps out at you. It's like it's overly photo referenced, but it's, you know, he creates the world that these characters inhabit. It's a close approximation of our world. So I think that's one reason why, even with some of the absurd stuff that Fox has in this script that Ted's doing with his cosmic rod, or that Dinah's, you know, able to judo flip a 8-foot tall gorilla, we buy it because he's done such a good job of solidifying this world that these characters are in.
Yeah.
And that's not as easy as it sounds.
Yeah, and you're right. Like, when she does those things, like, the sort of, he does a lot playing sort of like with depth of field that gives everything a little bit more of a sense of three-dimensional action. When she's flipping him over, when she and the Huntress are playing around the tree branch and they're kind of flipping forward, it gives things a little bit more of a texture, which is because again, it doesn't feel heavy. It doesn't feel like the sort of like kind of extreme type of style that we'd get in decades later. It's very classical. It's a little bit cinematic. Murphy Anderson did make these people look like movie stars, like you know, Hollywood celebrities, and maybe he was referencing specific people that he saw from movies or television. I don't know, but it has a realness to it.
Yeah. It's not like true realism, right. But it's like a hyper realism, mm-hmm. that he establishes for the book, for the story, and he, you know, it throughout the story. He delineates it in a way that it's, you know, nothing ever jumps out at you. It's like, oh, that doesn't look right. I mean, even the craziest things work, you know. Mm-hmm. You might look at him and say, well, that's kind of silly now, but you buy it, you know. And I do think, like I said, and this is not thrown off against any other artist at DC at the time, but, you know, if you look at, you know, even Gil Kane at this time wasn't the super dynamic, you know, Gil Kane that he would become with the crazy fight scenes, you know, where the person throwing the punches breaking every vertebrae in their back as they, you know, knock the guy clear across the panel and you're looking up his nose as he flies at you, you know. Mm-hmm. He wasn't doing that quite yet. Now, this is around the time he starts doing that. There's a lot of dynamic layout in this one, like when the Huntress and Black Canary are flipping each other around on this golf green, when she's leaping back into the panel on top of her, there's some great perspective shots. I mean, and of course he does it perfectly, you know, he executes it perfectly, but it's a lot more dynamic than what was going on in say, you know, Justice League or like I said, the Batman titles, pre Infantino. I mean, obviously, you know, once Infantino came in, got a lot more dynamic, but you know, Sheldon Moldoff and those guys were still a little stuck more in that more of that late golden age, early silver age kind of staid look to it. And I definitely think there's some dynamic stuff going on here that could rival, you know, some of the stuff going on at Marvel. And like I said, that's an interesting thing if you like listening to the Fantastic Cast and shows like that, which I enjoy, and you go back and look at these old Marvel comics, there's an energy there at Marvel, but it's a very early Marvel's very rough around the edges.
Yeah,
they had Jack Kirby drawing every. I mean, I think he was drawing a couple books with his feet. I mean, you know, he was drawing so damn much and outputting so much, and they relied on him so much, and Ditko was doing a ton of stuff, and it's just not as it just the DC stuff, the covers, the interiors, they always looked more finished. Sometimes you could say they weren't as exciting, and I think that's a fair assessment. But I think a book like this kind of challenges that. I think this shows that. Yeah, I mean, you don't have that the character that Stan Lee injected into them, where they have personalities that are distinctive. You know, but we're heading in that direction, you know, where Wildcat complains about getting left behind. I mean, that's a very human reaction, you know. And one thing I think is, you know, Black Canary holds her own in these stories. I like that because mm-hmm. we take that for granted now. But, you know, I feel like I'm beating up on Marvel, but I'm not meaning to. But if you read the early Fantastic Four, every time something horrible came up, and it did in every issue, Sue would say, "What does it mean, Reed?" And she'd cower in fear behind him. You know, of course, later we find out she's the most powerful member of the team. But,
right.
You know, as much as Stan did for character, you know, he didn't exactly make great strides in the women's lib movement, you know, with the portrayal of Sue there. But Black Canary, you know, she's picking up Sportsmaster and twirling over it. Whether it's kind of weird and silly or not, she's taking care of business. You know, she is, even without any powers, no canary cry here, obviously. She's, you know, she is right there toe-to-toe with the much more powerful Starman. So, mm-hmm. you know, go, girl. You know?
Right, and in the story before this, she essentially took out all of the Mist's goons, all of his hoods, everybody except for the Mist himself, who Starman took out himself. But so,
right.
And yeah, kind of getting into what you were saying, I wanted to kind of put in terms of Black Canary's appearances in context. She debuted in 1947. All of her appearances in Flash Commons were written by Robert Kanigher, drawn by Carmine Infantino. She was in a lot of issues of All-Star Comics until that stopped in 1951. And then in the 60s, she was in Justice League of America 21 and 22 by Sikowski. Those were in 1963, in 29 and 30 in 1964. And then these two issues. So these were sort of her... I mean, the Justice League, she was in four issues of Justice League of America, but it would have been two different stories. So these were sort of her third and fourth appearances in the Silver Age. And, I mean, I really think, like, Murphy Anderson gave her a look that I don't think anybody had probably ever seen her with before. Just the sort of the depiction, the characterization that he gave her features, her face, everything except for her cleavage, as we pointed out. And I think it was really... Because again, I found these stories in the Black Canary archives.
Okay. So
her Golden Age adventures are collected in one hardcover. Very, very highly recommended read. But yeah, 90% of this book is Carmine Infantino stories with Black Canary. And they're great. But you get to this page with Murphy Anderson, and it's... Wow, he drew her, he made her look different. This is a different era. This is a different flavor and style, and it really stands out. And then just for good measure, the last two stories are by Alex Toth. And it's like, okay, that is really extremely different.
Right, right. Yeah, those are great, though. I love those stories. Yeah, those were reprinted in the Adventure Comics Digest.
And then after these stories, she would be in a few other Justice League team-ups, and then by the end of the 60s, she would be a regular member of the Justice League of America and in Green Lantern, Green Arrow. So, after that, she was defined by other artistic talent. But I liked I liked the little statement that Murphy Anderson made on the character in these ones.
Yeah, definitely. I think he was probably, you know, even though Anderson was starting to work at DC right as the Golden Age was coming to a close. You know, I think he was probably one of the first artists to put the, at the time, modern stamp on the character, you know. So I can definitely see that. Because Sikowski, you know, he's kind of his own animal, really. You know, he's still kind of a controversial figure as far as, you know, people appreciate what he did, but at the same time, it's like, you always kind of wonder. I mean, he handled crowds great in Justice League, but his style was kind of iconoclastic. I mean, he's in a way, he's a little bit, you know, Frank Robbins is always kind of a controversial figure, but as how he illustrated superheroes. But you always kind of wonder, Anderson drew covers for Justice League. He inked Sikowski. It makes you wonder sometimes what would have happened if they just let Anderson draw the Justice League title. You know, maybe he didn't want to. I don't know. Maybe he's like, I don't want to draw that. Too many characters, you know. But it just makes you wonder if it, you know. I mean, I know Justice League sold like hotcakes back then. Yeah. But it's one of those what could have been type things. Nothing against Sikowski. Some of his you know, his figure work, his action, the poses he puts the characters in are just wonky. You know, especially compared to somebody that like Anderson, that almost everybody's almost in like a action ballet, you know. You know, there's a grace to everybody's movement. Even the thugs that they're beating up, they're falling with grace, you know, the way Anderson draws them. But you know, with Sikowski, it was all, you know, arms akimbo and weird positions, you know. So, but you know, it's so, especially because Anderson is so identified with the DC Silver Age, because, you know, he did ink. I mean, he touched every major DC Silver Age character, as well as drawing Hawkman, Spectre, Atomic Knights, you know, and those features, and Captain Comet. So, I mean, if you really think about it, probably maybe Infantino, because he later became the art director and then the publisher and designed a lot of covers, but he probably touched more characters in that period than any other artist. If there is anybody else, I don't know who it would be. I mean, Dick Dillon, you know, at the end of the Silver Age, into the Bronze Age, yeah, he probably, because he drew World's Finest and and different features like that is in DC Comics Presents, in addition to Justice League, then yeah, I'd say, you know, he's probably that of the 70s. He's that guy. But in the 60s, I'd say it's probably Anderson.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think Murphy Anderson kind of tapped into all of those classical characters at one point, either penciling or inking, kind of shaping some of those designs.
Yeah. Yep.
He was an extraordinary talent. I mean, he hadn't been working a lot, but just like the what he touched for the DC universe was made better. So
he was there for so long. Again, that's and because he did live longer than a lot of his peers, I think you can kind of, again, I keep saying take for granted, but I think you can take for granted his contribution because he was so integral to the DC Silver Age and the Bronze Age because of the Swanderson. Mm-hmm. Artwork and that's where he really started inking Superman a lot, was in the Bronze Age. But the way we see those characters, I mean, if I think the one image of as much as I love Dick Sprang, as much as I love Neil Adams, if I had to think of one image of Batman and Robin, and that my favorite image of them is by Carmine Infantino and Murphy Anderson, mm-hmm. where they're on the rooftop and Batman's pulling his cape around him and Robin's crouched down. It was the poster. It's the cover of Batman in the 60s. It's been everything. But I've got a little puzzle that comes in a can that's got that image on it. That's that image. That's Batman and Robin to me. So, I mean, that alone, that he defined the iconic images of those, so many iconic images of those characters, that makes him a very important part of DC's history.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good note to end on, I think. Chris, where can our listeners find you?
Well, they can find me and my wife, Cindy, on the Supermates podcast, where occasionally we cover the Starman Chronicles, where we cover the James Robinson, Tony Harris Starman series, starring Jack Knight, Ted's son, and Ted's also a character in that series. So you can find us there. When we're not covering Starman, we cover random comic-related stuff that just tickles our fancy. So check us out at supermatescomic.blogspot.com or on iTunes.
Well, thank you very much for once again coming back and being part of the Flowers and Fishnets. I always love talking to you, Chris.
Same here, man. Anytime.
If you're a fan of Murphy Anderson, there are a number of terrific podcasts and blogs celebrating his work this month. On episode 5 of Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal that just came out last week, the professor covered Anderson's work on Superman issue 254 and Legion of Superheroes 245 and 246. Rob Kelly and the Irredeemable Shag from the Fire and Water podcast are putting out a special Greatest Hits edition of their Who's Who podcast, honoring the best entries that Murphy Anderson illustrated for the series. That episode should be out this week. And in coming weeks, Comic Book Time Machine, episode 77, hosted by Ben Avery, will cover stories of the Atomic Knight from issues of Strange Adventures. On Head Speaks, episode 17, Aaron Moss will discuss Anderson's life and career, as well as covering the Spectre story from Showcase issue 60. And on episode 16 of Aaron's Task Force X podcast, Aaron will cover the first appearance of the Silver Age Atom from Showcase issue 34. I know that Paul Spataro is planning on talking about Murphy Anderson on an upcoming episode of Back to the Bins, and Clinton Robson is planning to cover an Anderson issue or two on his Coffee and Comics blog. That's a few that I know about, and I'm sure there are plenty of others out there. Murphy Anderson is certainly worthy of tribute. His long career speaks to his work ethic and talent, and the art speaks for itself. He'll be missed. And that does it for this episode of Flowers and Fishnets. If you enjoyed the show, you can leave a comment on the blogger page, blackcanaryfan.blogspot.com. There you can contact me with any questions or comments. You can also find me on Facebook and on Twitter using the handle @blackcanaryfan or @ryandaily01, or you can search the username Count Druncula. Flowers and Fishnets is not affiliated with DC Comics, and the views expressed on the show belong solely to the speaker. All music, audio clips, and quoted text are used for entertainment purposes and are believed covered under fair use. And I make no money off this podcast, so no copyright infringement is intended. Thanks for listening, and rest in peace, Murphy Anderson. Are you happy now?